12. Mr. President, Your Royal Highness, Mr. Minister, Your Excellencies, dear friends, ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues. My name is Katalin Bogyai. I'm Hungary's ambassador to the United Nations. Before that, I served at UNESCO as permanent delegate of Hungary, and also I was elected president of the UNESCO General Conference between 2011 and 2013. And as you heard in the first session, I was here already in 1999. Being in the Hungarian Parliament, I would like to dedicate my opening moments to an outstanding Hungarian scientist who presided over the Hungarian Academy of Sciences and served as a member of this parliament. A poet, a painter, he embodied the idea of a socially oriented and publicly conscious scientist, János Szentágotai, one of the most creative and renowned neurobiologists of the 20th century, a towering intellectual and a great humanist. More of a romantic visionary than an analytical scientist, Szentágotai could generalize his findings with an enchanting elegance. In the last two decades of his life as a religious man, he grappled with the scientific and philosophical problems of the brain-mind-psyche relationship, concluding in his paper titled Too Much and Too Soon, published in 1982, that no speculation can remove our responsibility for our actions and behavior. He was deeply concerned with and actively worked to avoid the abyss of an atomic holocaust as well as the destruction of the natural environment. Your Excellencies, dear guests, I also would like to dedicate my opening moments to another visionary, scientist and poet, whom you just heard before, UNESCO former Director General Federico Mayor, who indeed decided to bring the first World Science Conference of UNESCO to Budapest and start working with the Academy of Sciences. I was working for him then, between 1998 and 1999, as a filmmaker. And we were producing a documentary series about the responsibilities of the scientists in the 21st century. Today, the international community turns to scientists for answers to some of the most pressing social, economic, and environmental problems that transcend national boundaries. Whether it is an urgent task of halting climate change, an acute need to provide basic health care for large parts of the world population, or the shared responsibility to eradicate extreme poverty and hunger, the science of the 21st century is expected to point to the effective solutions. And still, we talk about the responsibility of the scientists. Your Excellencies, in neurobiology, there is a field known as the neurobiology of music, which reveals that our brain has no single music center. Instead, many areas of the brain work together to produce the complex experience we call music, including areas that regulate working memory for thought, movement, and emotion. Music's inherent symmetry and organizational principles step into a deep human need to order and to make sense of our environment, to understand the harmony of the universe. In this sense, music and art in general mimics science and represents an alternative portal to seeking truth, a perennial human preoccupation. And indeed, music might very well have inspired the greatest scientific discoveries of our era. The scientist who continues to personify the idea of a genius in our mind, of course, is Albert Einstein, who famously remarked, "If I were not a physicist, I would probably be a musician. I often think in music. I live my daydreams in music. I see my life in terms of music. I get most joy in life out of music." Music and art are great tools for diplomacy. Science is a great tool for diplomacy. Culture diplomacy and science diplomacy are often called the soft power of diplomacy. I don't believe that. Because really, if you use these tools, you have a chance that you build long-term bridges between people, countries, nations, and cultures. I'm a diplomat. I'm using culture, music, science, communication, building bridges between people. This very first morning is dedicated to diplomacy. We just know from Pasteur that science knows no country because knowledge belongs to humanity and is the torch which illuminates the world. And let me finish my introductory moments remembering the words of Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who sent a message to this very conference. He said to all of you, "To move forward on our path to sustainable development, we must combine scientific progress with responsible research and risk management. This calls for science that is inclusive, transparent, and grounded in ethics and human rights." Over the past 20 years, as he said, the World Science Forum has become a leading platform for scientific diplomacy, highlighting the most pressing challenges of our time and developing solutions to address them. So, these are the topics of this morning's discussion. I'm very honored that we will have a great speaker this morning. We will have Her Royal Highness Sumaya bin Al Hassan, who is the president of the Royal Scientific Society of Jordan, who has been involved, and her family has been involved for so long with the World Science Forum, and who hosted us so graciously and created really the memorable stay of our life in Jordan 2 years ago. Then we have Ms. Carol Mandel, who is the chief scientific advisor of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office of the UK. Then I will ask to come to the podium Teru Okishi, science and technology advisor from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Japan. And then Elisa Reis, vice president of the International Science Council. And then we will hear Simge Davulci-Menkel, who is the senior co-chair and mother-to-be from the International Consortium of Research Staff Association. Ladies and gentlemen, I remember 20 years ago when we started the movement here in Budapest, when the first science conference took place. And I remember the moment when really, the whole process continued, and we created the World Science Forum. And while I was president at UNESCO General Conference, we decided we would open up the World Science Forum, make it even more universal. So we decided to organize in every 4 years the forum in a different continent, in a different country. First, we went to Brazil, then to Jordan, and in 2 years, inshallah, we go to South Africa. This is the idea what keeps us going, and this is the idea what science diplomacy is about: interconnectedness, sharing the knowledge and learning from each other. So now it's a great honor for me to ask Her Royal Highness Sumaya Bint El Hassan to make her presentation. Your Royal Highness, the podium is yours.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allow me first to thank you, Madam Master of Ceremonies, if I can call you that, but dear friend, Madam Catalin Bogai, who has been such an inspiration to this series. I would also like to acknowledge the representative of the DG of UNESCO, Madame Shamila Nir-Boudel, and the South African Minister for Science and Technology, as well as so many distinguished people here in this room. But allow me, please, to thank our host, President Laszlo Lovas, and the entire team at the Hungarian Academy of Sciences for four tremendous days. And if you would allow me now, in particular, to ask two people who I think are always working so diligently, not only over the last 4 days, but in the last couple of years, to make sure that we are also lucky to be able to benefit from this wonderful hospitality. So Catalin Fodor and Gerge, can't see you right now, Gerge Bohm, thank you. Of course, deep thanks to the partners, to the steering committee members, and to all the members of the organizing committee who make sure that everything works according to plan. Ladies and gentlemen, it is an honor to address you at the closing of the World Science Forum 2019, and to be here again in this beautiful Parliament building that has stood through so much social and scientific change reminds us that nothing is constant, all is in flux, and so much of that change is made possible by the acts or omissions of humankind. I believe that from the very beginning of our journey together towards this and previous World Science Fora, over the course of 20 years, we have understood the need to leave a legacy, to make our meetings so much more than time-limited events, and to begin a process that would propel us to a more thoughtful, informed, and engaged future. So much of that legacy could not reveal itself for many years, but now we have begun to see how many younger scientists have been inspired. In fact, I'm very proud that the mean age of my delegation is actually 27 somehow, but that's what worked this time. How much innovative capacity has been unlocked through network building and discussion. We have nurtured and refined a forum that emphasizes the vital fact that science ingenuity is a stateless attribute. It is one of the great features of mankind's creative exceptionalism and not the exceptionalism of any particular nation or society. We must all make our contribution, and we must work to share the benefits of our global innovative capacity. For all humankind, science is the key to peace, health, and prosperity, not just in my challenged region, but around the world. Throughout history, science and innovation have provided the sturdiest framework for addressing challenges facing societies, as well as for enhancing the well-being of the community. Today, through common purpose and committed engagement, through current mechanisms and those yet to be created, we must reach out to nations, communities, and individuals across the globe to ensure that science is empowered as a right and as a mechanism to improve lives and environments. As we face great challenges, we must unlock the full positive potential of humanity, or risk the loss of untapped, innovative talent, continuing to paralyze holistic and systemic responses to grave threats. And if we are to place science at the heart of our national and global consciousness, then we must inevitably change the minds of those who doubt the capacity of science to inform good policy. We must engage and communicate with an appreciation of present challenges and a determination to shape a future that will make generations to come proud of our responses and our approach. Imagine that those future generations are watching us here and now. Let us make them proud. And let us not allow divisions of labor in our public and private spheres to keep us from creating new alliances of expertise and innovative hybrid practitioners who may find the most creative solutions possible. We can safely say that diplomats and scientists are not generally cut from the same cloth. Caution and circumspection are considered virtues in the former, while the latter must often break rules and disavow convention in order to forge a new and better reality. Each is a part of our global human consciousness, and we should at different times and in different circumstances be thankful for each. But it is the marriage of these extreme approaches that we are contemplating at this conference, so that innovative thinking and evidence-based solutions can survive the realities of our flawed world and make more of a difference through engagement and effective communication. For this marriage is essential if we are to produce ingenious and durable solutions to our greatest challenges. Scientists are driven by a dream of what is possible. Their refusal to accept the status quo has spurred progress through the ages, and today only scientific ingenuity can respond to the defining challenges of the 21st century. These challenges are not ideological, but existential, and our political machines must therefore facilitate and support global science. They must aid the deployment of creative ingenuity to ease crises and to unite us all in a common search for a better, more prosperous future. But this may only happen if we, scientists, science communicators, and science enablers, engage honestly and communicate wisely. Ladies and gentlemen, the World Science Forum in Jordan in 2017 started conversations and opened dialogues that had never been seen or heard before. Certainly not in my lifetime. Science spoke and politicians listened. And when the curtain came down, we continued to talk and we each had learned to listen and to hear just a little bit better. Our message is so clear to us in the echo chambers of scientific institutions around the world, but to make our message resonate in a political chamber such as this, we must communicate by acknowledging the realities of our political world. Stay true to truth, but stay present in the political structures of our far from perfect societies. We may not all live to see the scale of turmoil and change that this fine building has seen, but we may be sure that change will define all our future years. Let's do all we can to make it positive and peaceful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Royal Highness. She is the president of the Royal Scientific Society of Jordan, and I would like to say that Royal Highness was appointed in 2017 by the Director General of UNESCO as Special Envoy for Science for Peace. And it's always great to have you in Hungary. Now, it's a great honor for me to introduce another great woman scientist. And here I would like to just make a footnote. At the United Nations, we created the International Day of Women and Girl in Science. We will actually celebrate next year the fifth anniversary of this International Day. Hungary has been instrumental in that. So now I'm very honored to welcome Professor Carol Mundell, who is the Chief Scientific Advisor of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in the UK. She sits on a number of strategic advisory panels for the UK and international groups and is a committed communicator of science and is an advocate for diversity in science. Carol, the podium is yours.
Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, Your Royal Highness, it's a great honour and privilege to be here to speak to you today. And it's also been a great privilege to listen to some of the very thoughtful presentations and discussions that have happened through the week at the World Science Forum. So I particularly want to congratulate our eminent hosts and President Lazlov, particularly for the topic that was picked this year. As we've heard repeatedly today in this inspiring chamber, the importance of science diplomacy and reaching across national boundaries is of imperative importance for the future and security of our world. As an international scientist, I've always worked across international boundaries. I have collaborators and friends around the world, some of whom I've never met before, but we communicate electronically. And one of the things that struck me with the discussions the last few sessions and yesterday in the World Science Forum was the importance for scientists not only to recognize the importance of the work that they do, but to understand the responsibility that they carry. So it's a great honor to see that science is actually being put at the forefront of diplomacy, but of course, as scientists, we compete ruthlessly within our scientific spheres. So to listen to journalists, politicians, diplomats, policymakers talking about how we maintain the excellence of that science. And it is the excellence and the integrity that allows us then to use it as an instrument for diplomacy. So a free press, publishing industry that looks at the responsibility that it has when it actually reviews those international papers that come in for peer review, how we teach our young people how to do science responsibly, how we look at the reward system that we have for scientists. All of this is absolutely vital to keep the integrity of our international science community and the science offer that we then offer back to our politicians and our diplomats and our policymakers so that we can have the best evidence-based policy making at the heart of those policies. And of course, that international collaboration requires diversity. And the one thing I really wanted to raise in my speech today, because we've had much discussion of science diplomacy, and I know we have a room full of experts there, is one about equity and diversity. And when I look around the room today, I see significantly greater diversity than I see in my own field of physics. Women and girls continue to be underrepresented in all levels of decision making, globally, as well as in the UK. Women and girls must have a chance to participate in political life and decision-making and issues that concern their lives. Ensuring control over their own lives, their bodies, is fundamental to giving women and girls the ability to complete their education and fulfill their personal, political, and economic potential. And it's also vital that we work with men and boys in our communities so that we involve them in greater gender equality because it affects us all, and that we can all see the greater benefits that gender equality and wider diversity brings to society. To focus on gender equality as one example, the effect is holding the world back that we have inequality, prevents the development of secure, stable, and prosperous societies. Let me give you some numbers. 130 million girls globally do not have access to education. In conflict zones, girls are 2 to 3 times more likely to be out of school than boys. On current trends, it will take 170 years to close the global gender pay gap. That's a long time to wait. If women had the same role in labour markets than men do, up to an estimated $28 trillion could be added to the global GDP. So even if you're not very interested in diversity and equality, there is a really strong business imperative. In the field of science, technology, engineering and mathematics, many fewer girls than boys study these subjects, including digital subjects, and fewer women than men enter and remain, and that's important, in the STEM careers. In the UK, where we consider ourselves to be progressive, only 26% of core STEM graduates are women. And in other countries, that's significantly lower. And crucially, science and innovation has an essential role to play in finding the solutions to many of the common challenges that we've heard about today. Climate change, biodiversity loss, antimicrobial resistance, aging societies. And it is in all of our interests to harness the full talent we have in our societies. And ultimately, if one kind of person finds a solution to a question, that solution will be wrong for most of the people in the rest of society. In the UK, we're taking a number of initiatives nationally to try to address these challenges. And just practically, we will need an additional 700,000 STEM technicians and 1.8 million new engineers to meet the market and employer demand in the UK by 2025. That is a huge challenge. And investing in people, the young talent that we see around us, and ensuring that they can remain in education and develop their potential throughout their careers is an absolute imperative for all of our societies. So coming together here today, I hope that we will be able to harness all of the experiences in our different communities and think about how we lift up our young people, how we help them to realise their potential so that they can deliver to our greater common good. And I was very heartened to hear our South African colleague mention the Square Kilometre Array. I am an astrophysicist by background, and I've worked very closely in radio astronomy. And also our colleague from UNESCO. I did my PhD at Jodrell Bank at the north of England in Cheshire, the University of Manchester. For those of you who don't know this establishment, there is a giant radio telescope named after Sir Bernard Lovell. In 1957, that telescope was the only facility in the Western world that could track the rocket that launched the Sputnik satellite. The Sputnik satellite itself gave out a very strong signal that virtually anybody could pick up. The carrier rocket itself could not be tracked. And this was, of course, at the heart of the Cold War. And the heart of the Cold War, it was difficult for scientists to work across the Iron Curtain. But radio astronomers and space scientists from Russia, the UK, and indeed the US, but particularly through that radio astronomy link, did continue to work throughout the Cold War. When I became a PhD student, I had the pleasure to work with Russian scientists who were trying to figure out how we could look at a radio window, a window on the universe that had previously been obscured by communication satellites. And we did a very special piece of collaboration where our Russian military colleagues agreed to switch those global navigation satellites off one by one for 24 hours. Unprecedented. And it was a huge privilege to hear that the Lovell Telescope was given UNESCO and World Heritage status. It is not a museum, it is a world-leading science facility, and the international headquarters of the Square Kilometre Array sits on that site underneath the Lovell Telescope. So to see the innovation that astronomy is driving and has been driving now for many decades, and to see the excitement of young people who visit or who live in South Africa and who will now work as part of a global science community, driving forward to the frontiers of knowledge in our universe, is of particular personal pleasure to me. My final point is about us being good custodians of the natural world. We've had a space race, we've had the Convention on the Peaceful Use of Space, we now have many economies that want to emerge into the space industry and launch, for example, communication satellites. And this is an exciting and new emerging area of technology. We will have digital connectedness around the world. But at the same time, we're creating a new environmental disaster in space. There are over 1.5 million particles that are about a centimetre in size of man-made space debris. Those particles, if one of those hits your space asset, it will explode with the energy of a hand grenade. So as we launch more bits into space, more bits can crash into other bits and create more bits. We not only need technological solutions to that, we also need diplomatic and political agreements about the norms of behaviour and the rule-based international system and how we work together so that our nations can benefit and prosper, but also do that in a sustainable way. So I look forward to talking with you more today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carol. Very inspiring words. We will continue later on in a panel format. But now I would like to invite Professor Teruo Kishi, Science and Technology Advisor at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Japan. The professor he is the president of the Innovative Structural Materials Association. He is NIMS Advisor Emeritus of the National Institute of Materials Science, after serving as the first president of NIM from April 2001 till 2009. Professor, you are also an emeritus professor at the University of Tokyo, and we are eager to listen to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for introduction. I'm planning to use PowerPoint, but that's not move.
No? Could we ask, could we help with the slides, please?
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, thank you. Nice introduction. Okay, good morning, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's my great pleasure to give my talk here at the big and excellent room and higher place here. Okay, my name is Kishi, Science and Technology Advisor to the Minister for Foreign Affairs of Japan. I'm very glad to be here to discuss 20 years of science diplomacy with distinguished colleagues. As you know, it has been almost 10 years since the Royal Society published a report called New Frontiers in Science Diplomacy, which advocate three dimensions of science diplomacy: science in diplomacy, diplomacy for science, and science for diplomacy. As various countries and sectors have been promoting science diplomacy and its importance increase year by year after year. In 2018, Sir Peter Gluckman, Dr. Trekian, and Dr. Grimes and I co-authored a paper to emphasize three types of practical actions to implement science diplomacy, that is, actions for national needs, action for cross-border interest, and action for global needs and challenges. In Japan, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs decided to assign science and technology advisor to the minister to bridge science and diplomacy. In September 2015, I was appointed as the first advisor. For more than 4 years, I have made some contributions. Okay, I introduce my work a little bit. My activity include, firstly, preparing recommendations and advice for the foreign minister toward important diplomatic events such as G7, G20, TICAD, SDI for SDGs. Secondly, disseminating Japan's science and technology in both Japan and abroad through more than 70 lectures. This corresponds to diplomacy for science. And thirdly, establishing the network with science advisors and other experts overseas. This corresponds to science for diplomacy. Based on such experiences, I'd like to talk something about what I I had an experience. As you see in this project, the ultimate purpose of diplomacy is security and trade. But recently, in addition, dealing with global issues such as SDGs has become an important agenda. The role of science and technology in these three agendas of diplomacy, that is security, trade, and global issues, is becoming increasingly important. Firstly, in security agenda, it is important to disseminate values such as reciprocity, openness, and transparency that have been shared in the field of science in democratic nations to the world. That will lead to promote science as well as contribute to global security through fostering research, security, and integrity. And secondly, in the case of trade and commerce, promoting global research collaboration by securing diversity will accelerate innovations and contribute to create new economic values and economic growth. In the meanwhile, when we conduct innovative cutting-edge research activities, we sometimes have to deal with dual-use technologies, military and civil technology. This is a big issue in Japan. At such times, we must not rush, but must deepen the understanding of all stakeholders involved and deal appropriately. Okay, thirdly, to tackle with global issues, there is no argument that science, technology, and innovation, SDI, plays critical roles, and SDI for SDGs should be definitely promoted globally. When tackling actions for global needs and challenges, coordination by international organizations such as the United Nations will become more than important. Okay, here, looking to the next 20 years, the response to digital science will be the most important agenda. Next 20 years will be now the age of data science, we can say. However, hard science, such as nanotechnology and material science, is also very, very important as well. Therefore, Japan is aiming at Society 5.0, the concept of the Society 5.0, which emphasizes the fusion of cyberspace and physical space. What is a fusion technology? For example, sensing and advanced actuators issues is a typical one. In the field of medical and robotics and automobiles and space, this type of fusion technology will become very, very important in future. So, how to realize this Society 5.0? For achieving the Society 5.0, cross-sectional collaboration and global collaboration are critical. Japan's role is to drive the world through problem-solving research in an inclusive manner, as emphasized in SDGs. At this time, expanding SDI in development policy, that is ODA, is also important for SDI for SDGs. As the science and technology advisor to the foreign minister, I will encourage these ideas to stakeholders in Japan from now on. So, in this case, how to promote international collaborations? When promoting global research collaboration, it is critical to grasp the needs and science and technology trend of the partner countries. I believe it is better to promote win-win collaboration on cutting-edge science among developed countries. On the other hand, when collaborating with developing and emerging countries, it is required social implementations of technologies to lead industrial growth directly or human resources development based on establishment of science and engineering university or research site. In any case, there exists no border in basic science, and cooperation with all countries should be strengthened. On the other hand, we have to take care of technology. I say science and technology, but in the case of science, collaboration is okay in every time. But in the case of technology, we have to be sometimes be nervous and take care of it. This is one of the important issues from now on in the case of international collaborations. Okay, let's summarize my talk at this slide. Yeah, as you see in this figure, towards next 20 years, Trinity, that is diplomacy, science and technology, and between the existence of science and technology diplomacy, these three will become very, very important. And in the case of science and technology, having a melting pot atmosphere, which means which corresponds to diversity, and we should carry out the fusion technology, and we would like to have an inclusive society in future. This corresponds to Society 5.0. And in the case of diplomacy, security, trade, and global issues, and science diplomacy will become the very global and bridging strong powers, I hope. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Professor Kishi. And now I would like to ask to the podium Professor Eliza Rice, who is the Vice President of the International Science Council. She is also a fellow member of the Brazilian Academy of Sciences and of the World Academy of Sciences. Where are you, Eliza?
Okay, well, it's an honor to salute Madame the Moderator, Your Excellencies, fellow scientists, distinguished guests. Well, after these so inspiring discussions and new ideas we have heard, I knew there was not much left for me to say when my time comes. So I decided to take an unusual path. I decided to bring back somehow the naive perspective that I had 20 years ago when I was here in Budapest as an observer invited by the Brazilian Minister for Science and Technology. So with that taking privilege of naivete, I will take back some trivial aspects about science diplomacy, also some illustrations of the progresses we have made, and some things I think are still demanding more attention from us. Well, if I look at science diplomacy from a naive perspective, it includes so many varieties. For example, who are the addressees? Governments, specific policy actors, private sectors, citizens? Well, could be all of them. What is the focus? It could be single or plural. What is the scope? Could be national or even subnational, international or global. The composition of science diplomacy can be disciplinary, multidisciplinary, or transdisciplinary. Yet there is a commonality to all those varieties. Every single perspective aims at furthering instrumental and moral science goals. I think that we have a symbolic capital. Science is a symbolic capital because we share principles, values, and protocols, also scientific initiatives. We constitute a community of ideals and interests because, after all, science communitarian identity contributes to overcome ideological barriers and power disputes. Of course, we need a lot of words of caution. We know that hidden barriers persist within science as well, but also between North and South, genders, disciplines, etc. Yet science can be the very antidote to combat such barriers inside and outside. If I look at the past accomplishments of the science community, the World Science Forum is already a culmination of an effort, a big fruit of 100 years of scientific collaboration. I mean, if the International Research Council started 100 years ago, and along this path, we had several indicators of successful scientific collaboration, such as UNESCO itself, interdisciplinary unions, or disciplinary unions, ICSU, ISSC, the World Science Forum, IAP, INGSA, Young Academies. We have a plethora of new initiatives. The diversity of objectives they have, rather than an obstacle, has been an asset to partnership between different scientific organizations. So, past experience tell us that we have the power. We can accomplish a lot. If I think of my personal experience as former member of the International Science Social Science Council, I see the International Science Council now as a result of some internal diplomacy. We finally merged together because we realized how important it is to merge together science and social science, because after all, we are all sciences. As you know, the International Science Council, I don't have to repeat myself much, but you know that we have 140 national and regional scientific associations, 40 international scientific unions, and a lot more. Our science plan stresses four major axes: the Sustainable Development Goals, the Digital Revolution, Science in Policy and Public Discourse, and the Evolution of Science and Science Systems itself. I think with plot of things, we have a lot to benefit from all of you here and for all the scientific organizations who are advancing social science diplomacy. Science and diplomacy has a lot of prospect for progress. I think after discussing all the problems we face, in this final session we are also entitled to some optimistic look, and that's what I'm trying to convey here. Apart from ourselves, there are also other examples that we are not even aware of. Just by chance, I am aware of one, I was part of one initiative which is called the International Panel for Social Progress. Actually, we were inspired by the IPCC. We decided it's time for social sciences to get together and to work on a big report on what have been the progress that we made in the last 50 years or so, what are the focus things that we fail, and what should we do from now on. We also invited some humanities, and we managed to get together around 300 social scientists from all the world, with all the difference that you know social scientists have among themselves, and still we managed to elaborate a 3-volume report that was published last year by Cambridge University Press. There are other examples that we mentioned here, but I think we have to be open to all these small or partial initiatives that join the effort we do as larger associations. Why we have to do that? We all know why we have to do that. We know that science is more than ever the key instrument to promote peace, progress, inclusion. I was glad to hear Carol talking about social inequality. That's my field of research, but I don't have to add anything to what she's already said. I really want to leave time for discussion, so I will conclude with just a few remarks. First, I would say that how we see the present conforms our vision of the future. Second, science has to be a renewed enlightenment. There are too many threats to enlightenment at the moment, and we need to think of science as re-enlightening. Science diplomacy is a major ethical commitment, and with these 3 points in mind, I would say that how we choose among alternatives shapes our future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Rice. I would like to ask Dr. Simge Davulcu-Menket, Senior Co-Chair of the International Consortium of Research Staff Association, to come to the podium.
Thank you, Madam Catalin, for the introduction. Welcome to the last part of the session. His Excellency, President of the World Science Forum and the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, László Lovász, Her Royal Highness, President of the Royal Scientific Society of Jordan, Sumaya bint al-Hassan, and dear distinguished guests. I would like to start my presentation by expressing how honored I am to be here on stage in the Hungarian Parliament today with hundreds of great scientists and policymakers to share the journey of science diplomacy and its achievements in the last divided capital of Europe, Nicosia. I would also like to thank the World Science Forum steering and the organizing committees, as well as the Global Young Academy and the International Consortium of Research Staff Associations for giving me the opportunity to be here today. I am beyond excited to share with you the journey of introducing science diplomacy in Cyprus, where it has taken us so far, and where it may take us in the future. Diplomacy is one of the most powerful tools of the global world, especially for those regions under conflict. And when diplomacy goes together with the enabling power of science, many great achievements and changes can be made across communities. I was born into a divided country, Cyprus, in 1988. That is 14 years after the division of the island. And for most of my life, I have lived in a country without not knowing what is on the other side of the border, until I studied organic chemistry and started wondering about using science for the benefit of my country. Then the questions started coming to my mind, and one of them was, which side is my country? And of course, the answer to that is all of it, because science does not have any borders. No matter how divided or conflicted the Turkish and the Greek Cypriots are on the island, we know that we are united by the same ecology, we are united by the same sunshine, and we're also united by the same environment and the shared natural resources. As a Cypriot scientist, I am probably exposed to the term diplomacy much more intensely than any other European scientist. This is due to the repeated rounds of failing peace talks to reunite the island, ongoing for the past 45 years. The prolonged process is somewhat resulting in the diminishing of hopes for a possible sustainable solution, and it surely has many negative impacts on the society, on the economy, hence political stability, but it also has a huge effect on the early career scientists and researchers. Early career researchers are surely the knowledge capital and the future of a country. Several studies have shown that the brain drain in Cyprus is above 30%, and it has negative effects on the productivity and economy. A substantial trend in the brain drain has also been demonstrated to exist in the small regions by studies where there is an east-west or a north-south divide. Political instability surely plays a big part in the brain drain of the highly qualified young scientists, mainly in the form of inclination to stay abroad after completing their studies. Early career researchers have the fear of not being able to find a sustainable or a satisfactory job in their profession where there would be opportunities for growing, developing and progressing in their career in their homeland. This was also one of the major highlighted points yesterday by the young scientists from the Arab region in the research career discussions as part of the thematic session of ICORSA on responsible research and innovation and research integrity across the globe. It is a common challenge to the MENA region and the Levant region. Science diplomacy is definitely needed more than ever to open up opportunities for scientists and researchers internationally and locally, and to also build bridges between the divided communities in the conflicted zones. I would like to briefly project the efforts on science diplomacy on the local level in Cyprus. So we had a vision in our divided capital, Nicosia, and that was to focus on what unites us and brings us together. We would like to plant seeds of peace in the young minds through science to build a better future, and use science diplomacy to open up a dialogue between the two communities of Cyprus and encourage collaboration. We introduced science diplomacy to Cyprus in 2016 by the foundation of the Science for Peace Initiative by a bicommunal group of local scientists. The initiative runs with the slogan Science Overcomes Borders, and it aligns with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals 16 and 17, striving to encourage all researchers of Cyprus to form scientific collaborations, reminding them that although we are divided by borders, we are united by the same challenges on the island and the region. The initiative also organizes and supports some fantastic bicommunal STEM workshops, including organic chemistry for kids, Cafe Scientific for science communication and science for community, astrophysics workshops, science festivals, science spa projects, and STEM girls projects for inclusive science, and many more. On the global level, our continued efforts for doing science across borders includes creating more and more opportunities for early career scientists to form international collaborations. Last December, I had the pleasure of organizing a meeting in Cyprus to bring early career researchers from all around the globe under the umbrella. Innovation. Let me tell you, it is not very common to hold a scientific meeting in the United Nations, so-called the buffer zone, in Cyprus. But we did it, together with Future Earth and ECRNON, standing for the Early Career Researcher Network of Networks. I am a member of ICORSA as a young researcher, and one of the missions of ICORSA is doing science diplomacy and promoting peace. ICORSA is a partner in a project called the RING Project, which stands for responsibility and responsible innovation and all the elements of human rights. The project actually sets a truly global example of science diplomacy by encouraging global collaboration in RRI principles and practices. The representatives of the ECRNON, with active members in the MENA regions, together with 25 local Cypriot scientists, were introduced to the project, to the concept of science diplomacy, and they also received RRI training during a two-day program in Cyprus. All these points bring me to say conclusively that, from an early career perspective, the unified voice of young scientists must be heard, and the concerns of the future generations should be brought to the tables of the governors. As the systems become more polarized and governed by more and more nationalistic policies, the responsibility of science, and especially the young scientists, increases. Science diplomacy provides fact-based language and platform for opposing political quarters, and sound science systems do prevent conflict and wars. So today, I hope to be the voice to share the need for science diplomacy in Cyprus and the region more than ever. And I would like to add that the hopes of the youth for a united, developed, and for a better Cyprus are not finished. I would also like to make a wish, if I may, on behalf of the younger generation to invite the leaders of Cyprus to take a step towards a collaborative approach in the peace talks at the upcoming trilateral meeting hosted by the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres next week in Berlin. Our efforts in Cyprus and in region are only a very small part of the global science diplomacy, but I believe we must start from home to spread peace internationally. Therefore, I would like to finish off my words with a famous quote, "Peace at home, peace in the world." Thank you.
Thank you so much. I especially liked your motto, "Science overcomes border," how to support peace and reconciliation between the two communities in Cyprus. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to ask the honorable panelists to come to the podium. So, Royal Highness, Carol Mandel, Teru Professor Kishi, Eliza Reis, Simge, please come back. And I would like also to ask our keynote speaker, Elmel William Cordlaser, to join us. Thank you very much for the great presentations. We are really here today to take a stock of the past 20 years of science diplomacy, of course, but also to look into the future and share our thoughts on the biggest challenges we are facing nowadays. Science will stay as a key contributor in overcoming challenges and finding the best solutions of the future, we heard from everybody. Albert Einstein cautioned us that no problem can be solved from the same level of consciousness that created it. And I would like to start our conversation with this idea, with this motto. What have we done well, good, and what have we, in what have we failed, what should be restored, how better solutions we should find. So start to take the stock of the 20 years and look forward. Your Royal Highness, would you like to? Okay.
So thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes. I have.
Thank you, Madame Bogai. And well, as I said in my speech, I think that it's interesting to see that after 20 years we are coming full circle. Apart from anything else, I think that certainly, from my standpoint, I've been able to witness a much more of a development when it comes to science diplomacy, but we still have a long way to go in convincing our decision makers that evidence-based policy making is the way to go, and to listening to the voice in the heart of the science community is certainly a big step. However, I remember at the previous World Science Forum, when we were talking about science advisors to governments, and at that point I think we noted that there were only 7 in the world who were given that official title of science advisors to governments. Today I feel that looking around the room, and certainly over the last 4 days, the position has been fulfilled much more. And certainly if we are to talk about transboundary science, when we look at countries or nations, particularly my part of the world, when we talk about issues such as water management, water crises, we know that probably in my part of the world, contaminated drinking water is probably the biggest weapon of mass destruction that we could ever encounter. And so it is the role of the science community to be able to impact the decision makers to take into account what we are doing. We have a little bit of a two-step forward, one-step back situation, in that they will listen to us when it pleases them. But I think that today has really shown, and again, speaking here in this very momentous, on this very momentous occasion and from this very prestigious hall, that certainly it is the science voice that has to be taken in terms of planning for the future, for peace and prosperity in my region. And I just would like to, I know I've spoken a lot, but I would just like to say, I think one of the very tangible deliverables that came out of the last World Science Forum that was recognized at this World Science Forum was the delivery of a charter of ethics for research in the Arab world. And I think this in itself has really proved that we will be able to continue to put science at the top of any of our development agendas for the future. And I take the opportunity to invite everybody to the first Arab Science Forum that we hope to host in 2021, another deliverable of the 8th World Science Forum. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Princess Sumaya was talking about the lack of listening of the governments. But now we have in our panel two advisors to government. So, Carol, what is your experience? I mean, how do you see really the experience of yours? You talked about that already a little bit in the past. And how would you like to improve that? And also, are they listening to you?
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me? I don't have a microphone. So my experience, I've been in the Foreign Office for 1 year now. I have worked in international science policy before that, but not as a civil servant. So 3 days a week, I am a civil servant, and I'm bound by the Civil Servants Code, and that means that I provide the best possible advice, evidence-based advice, to my ministers. And the role that I play is actually one of translation. And it's not always appropriate to take a scientist from the lab and confront them immediately with a politician, because these two communities work in very different worlds. One of the challenges we have with science advice is that the word science conjures up a very narrow view in most people's eyes of what that is. And with respect, it's a white-haired, genius male scientist, probably in a lab in a white coat. And, you know, Madam Chair, you've mentioned Albert Einstein many times. And, in fact, when you ask people, can you name great scientists, or you Google great scientists, you get lots of eminent men. If you ask school children to name a woman scientist, it's universally Marie Curie. Mm. Now, last year, Professor Donna Strickland, won the Nobel Prize in Physics. She's only the third woman ever to do so, and the first one in 55 years. And I saw a huge change in people's conversations. She was uncomfortable with the label a woman physicist. She's a physicist. And so what I've noticed in government is that I have a very important role to understand the pressures of my ministers. They have very busy portfolios, and they're generalists. And my civil servant diplomatic colleagues have huge skill in the diplomatic sphere and also are generalists with very, very busy day jobs. And so it's my job to understand the science that I'm putting into the advice, the limitations of that science and that science advice, as well as its power, and understand the scientific method. So there are two important things that I do beyond science for diplomacy, science and diplomacy for scientists. Is actually making sure that the scientific method underpins the processes that happen in the Foreign Office. Mm-hmm. What are our underlying assumptions when we decide to develop a piece of policy? And how have we actually gathered the evidence or the data that we need to inform those decisions when we provide advice to ministers? The other part is one of translation back into our research communities. At the moment, the UK is working to leave the European Union, and our academic community they are independent, they have an independent voice. Our universities are autonomous organisations, they are not run by government. And so the learned societies and our universities and our research communities have made representation to government. Sometimes that has been heated, sometimes it has been very emotionally, understandably so. But my experience has been that when there is evidence on the table, we are able to take it to ministers and they listen and they understand the position. They can then take their decisions based on that objective evidence with their own political ideas, ideals and pressures. And in fact, I've seen a very positive dialogue between the two with that translation piece in the middle. But as I say, if you take an angry scientist and confront them with a busy minister, you're not going to get that listening that's needed. So that's really the role of the science advisor.
Yeah, thank you very much. Professor Kishi, I know from everyday life that, for example, in the United Nations, we can see how Japan uses very strongly science diplomacy, building very important international connections, and actually influencing movements. If you talk about universal health coverage, if you talk about science and innovation and so on. So you as an advisor to your government, how would you take stock of the past and how do you see the future? What are the challenges for you?
Yeah, as a science advisor, as I told, my job is to make a bridge between science and diplomacy, and always to complete this job. Diplomacy include international collaboration very much. Mm. Yeah, and in future I would like to expand our collaboration much more optimistically. But the one of the big issue is this is a session of science diplomacy. I am a science and technology advisor. Yeah, we use technology. In the case of science, it's no problem to have much more contact with each other in every country. But in the case of technologies, sometimes we have a nervous point. Yeah, this is a very, very important issue for us. And in addition, in Japan, after the last war, we are prohibited to carry out military research work. But the military and civil research are combining very much now. So I believe strictly that this type of science advisor's job is very, very important, hope in future. But now we have some important two points. How to deal with technologies in international collaborations, and how to carry out this type of dual use in future. That's my opinion. But personally, I would like to be optimistic much more for science advisors. Yeah, that's my conclusion so far. Yeah.
So far. Yeah. Thank you very much. I would like to ask Simge, you talked about your fantastic projects, and they are really building trust, aren't they? Not building trust and understanding. And me as a diplomat, I'm not a scientist, but I'm using science diplomacy to connect the people, the countries, and building trust. So in practice, what are your results? And the way you are working today, could you have done it before? And how do you see the future?
Thank you for the question. So, could we have done it before? I think I'll start from there. The answer to that is probably yes. And although science diplomacy is fairly new and just been introduced to Cyprus, as far as we know, in 2016, scientists have been doing this for mostly the last decade, just without knowing that they were actually doing science diplomacy. So scientists from both communities of Cyprus have been collaborating on issues such as looking at the shared ecology, you know, tracking birds, because birds doesn't know any borders. So if you want to collect samples from anywhere on the island, you have to cross borders and apply trans-border science and use your skills. So I think it has been going on for a while. They just didn't know that they were doing science diplomacy. So knowing that you are doing it under such a term, I think it's more empowering. And about the results, we are more oriented towards youth, seeing them as the future of the country. Of course, there are lots of barriers, official, bureaucratic, or even logistic, bringing children together. There's the language barrier, speaking Turkish and Greek, but there's always a way. You can use English and have translators, and you can make them meet in the middle in the United Nations zone with the support from UNESCO. So the results are very promising and increasing hopes for the future. And looking into the future, I think these type of activities definitely will have an effect on the minds of the young children, because if I just look back and reflect back on my childhood, without going back too much to the previous generation who have seen war and conflict, I didn't get to play with my Cypriot friends over the border. I didn't get to do experiments with them and share science and think maybe with a different view and, you know, have more rational decisions and come up with the ideas that everyone may not have the same idea, and it is okay to discuss and such. So developing communication and soft skills, I think, is the main result out of these projects and activities on the smaller scale. So it is very hopeful and promising for the future.
Thank you very much. We talked today quite a lot about the so-called SDGs. I'm sure everyone knows the SDGs, but it's sometimes hard to remember because we talk about no poverty, zero hunger, good health and well-being, quality education, gender equality, clean water and sanitation, affordable and clean energy, decent work and economic growth, industry, innovation and infrastructure, reduced inequality, sustainable cities and communities, responsible consumption and production, climate action, life below water, life on land, peace and justice, strong institution, partnership to achieve the goal, and that's goal 17. So it's a very complex way of thinking. We at the UN have been working very hard to get all the 193 countries actually to agree on that. But I think it really gives a great sort of framework. And we have an ongoing discussion. Yesterday we talked about that. It was really a brilliant discussion organized by Japan. Where are we now? As you come from Brazil, we had an amazing World Science Conference there 4 years ago. So how do you see what is the role of science diplomacy and all that? Because in a way, in all the goals, you need, of course, diplomacy. And actually, in a way, science diplomacy has to be part of that. The two words together, right?
Of course, the complexity of the 17 goals is really a big challenge. And I think we have to stress communication between sciences in order to see how to better interact, see the interactions. And I also think that part of the problem is to convince not only governments, but also the citizens, the union, the civil society, that the question of inclusion, it's not a question of charity or philanthropy. It's a way to generate public good. And this idea of generating public good, I think it's something to connect all the 17 goals, because they all have that specific aim, but if they don't come together, it's impossible. And in order to make them really to merge together, we have to include everybody. The idea of no one left, it's really more active than it sounds. It's a mandatory call. In a way, if we don't convince people that we are all members of the same boat, there's no way, there's no salvation.
Mm. And here we come again to communication, and lastly, that's why I wanted to ask Mr. Cole Glazer about the role of education, communication. One of the greatest movies is The Lost in Translation, and I always think about that when I try to work with my colleagues from different parts of the world, and that's why I believe so much that the so-called soft power and communication is number one, because how on earth could I make peace with someone whom I don't understand, whom culture I don't understand. So in your experience, the past 20 years, because it's the stock-taking moment, and the future, how would you summarize that?
Yeah. Well, first on communication, when I served in the U.S. State Department and also was involved in the U.N. on the role of science and technology innovation for the SDGs, I think the biggest lesson I learned, I was not a professional diplomat. I learned the most important thing that scientists can do is to listen and try to understand the needs and the problems of the people, the political people, the decision makers, the ambassadors who are working. Once you can see exactly what they're worried about and what their problems are, then you can actually try to put together the science advice that can be very relevant for what they're most interested in. The scientists who did least well in that environment, the ones who saw it as an opportunity to lecture to the politicians and the ambassadors as opposed to spend more time listening to make sure you understand their needs. It's also true between different cultures. And I went away with tremendous respect for the real diplomats in our foreign ministries for the U.S., for the U.S. Department of State. For anyone that's watched the television of the last 2 weeks, I was very proud of some of the professional diplomats in the U.S. Department of State that had to testify before Congress. The one other thing I might mention in all the meetings and talking when I was in the State Department to people about science and technology around the world, and I mentioned that everyone wanted to talk about innovation and how science and technology can contribute. Particularly for emerging countries, the three pieces of advice that I offered was the three most important things that they could do that would really stimulate what they were seeking to accomplish. One was empowering the women in their society if they had not done that, so they were tapping this tremendous resource that they were not using it to its utmost that was holding them back. Two was to expand mobile broadband, the great communication tools that have been created, including opportunities for income-generating opportunities for people in emerging countries. And the third was not to forget fundamental basic research. A number of countries feel like it's, that they don't have the luxury for investing in fundamental or basic research for their people, that they have to focus solely on national needs. I would try to make the case that fundamental basic research is absolutely key for training the next generation, for building the capacity in their countries. But if they try to include all three of these elements in their plans, I tried to help convince them that they would accelerate their economic growth and prosperity.
Thank you very much. I really would like to thank our distinguished panelists for their valuable contributions. I'm truly enriched with the wealth of ideas, proposals, and the analysis of problems we heard this morning. The most important takeaway from today's panel is the reinforcement of the science policy link by bringing together all actors from the political, researcher, and implementation level. Concerning what is commonly viewed as soft power, I talked about, is in today's globalized world more potent, more tangible, and more consequential than the so-called hard power, with all its traditional economic and military leverages of influence. It is our duty within the multilateral organizations, and here I'm talking about myself as well, old UNESCO member and now the UN, that within the national government and the civil society to make sure that our future as humankind is shaped more through the soft power than the instruments of hard power. I would like to thank the panelists being here with us. I would like to thank Mr. President, Madam Deputy Director General of UNESCO, AAAS, all the partners for the last 20 years. Working together with you was a blessing for all of us. Thank you.